This evening's speaker is Larry Yanning. Larry is part of Jack Kornfield's teacher training program at Spirit Rock. He leads day-long retreats for people of color on issues concerning diversity and recovery from addiction. He has spent 6 months in Thailand as an ordained monk.
Thank you, Maureen.
If we come to the point where there are questions and answers from the audience, if we could pass the microphone, it makes for a better recording, and it helps people who are using the hearing-assisted devices because they go through the speaker system.
Thank you for having me again. It's always so sweet to come into this space. It's really, you have such a gift of practice here. And actually, just to tag on to your announcements, I mentioned this on Sunday when I was here last, that on June 2nd is going to be the first day long for people of color in this space. And it's an incredible opportunity for your community to explore these issues. And it's so that the event itself, even though that event for that day, of course, are for people who identify as people of color, but it actually is an invitation into a larger collective conversation on how do these issues impact your community, whether they're relevant or not, how you feel about them. Because there's a lot of diversity within just how to hold the experiences of difference. I would invite you into the conversation even though there are differences of opinion, because living with these differences is actually the creation of peace. It's when we cannot live with differences and we begin to move to obliterate them is when war starts. And so when we can have these conversations over difference and be able to hold it within our spiritual practice, then we begin to actually practice and begin to be able to take this out into the world so that we can affect a very wounded world that's out there. So anyway, I just thought I'd mention that as an announcement. So last year, it's about 18 months ago, I went to Thailand and I ordained with one of the meditation masters in northern Thailand. And they have a tradition in Thailand of doing temporary ordinations, which suited me since I have a partner, I have a livelihood, I have aging parents. So I have this world that is here in the Bay Area that I couldn't completely disengage from. And so I don't know if any of you have traveled in Thailand, but one of the most beautiful cities in Thailand is in the north, called Chiang Mai. And it's cooler than the south, and it's very forested. And so when I arrived in Chiang Mai, I spent a week just getting over jet lag and also acclimating to the culture and the rhythm of just the lifestyle. And I found myself doing things for the last time. So, you know, there were 6 days left before it was to go into the temple. So I went out and got a massage. There were 5 days left, and I went out, and there's a Starbucks there. So I got my Starbucks. You know, there were 4 days left to the ordination, and I went to do my yoga class. And then there were 3 days left, and And I had this curious thought that, you know, there were 3 days left of freedom before I went into this monastic container that was about renunciation. And the next thought that came up to me was, am I going away from freedom or towards it? So that's what I want to talk about tonight, is freedom. And the subtitle is, the freedom that we search for isn't necessarily the one that we want. So I had the very fortunate, I was very fortunate when I had this period of ordination. Normally when you ordain, even if it's temporarily, you're obligated to stay in the temple for up to 5 years. And so if you've only ordained for 6 months, you're obligated to stay in the temple because it's a training, and you're training with your preceptor or your abbot. But for some reason, my abbot sensed that I was there from the West, and he really gave me a lot of latitude, and so I was able to, he sent me on pilgrimage to India, and so I was able to travel as a monastic, which was very interesting in terms of holding the precepts or the guidelines of how monks and nuns are in the world. And it really was so clear how many freedoms that we have in the West, that we have so many political and spiritual and cultural freedoms for most of us, that we're not under. When I was in Nepal, there was this huge political upheaval over the basically the dictatorship of the king, and even though there are differences in gender experience and then disparities even within gender experience in the West, it's certainly not as severe or marked as traditional Asian cultures in which the gender disparity and the patriarchy is so sometimes painful. Then we have just so many freedoms around just this bubble that we live in, and around being able to access food or health care. The one thing that came up to me over and over again when I came back to the United States was water. You know, the fact that I could open my mouth while taking a shower really struck me, because you can't do that in all of these countries. And the freedoms that we completely take for granted. So in this culture that we live in, for most of us, we can do many of the things that we want and actually attain them. And the question is this ability to do what we want to do, whenever we want to do, with whomever we want to do, is this freedom? Is this enough? And the Buddha actually invites us into this question and to explore it for ourselves when he was Siddhartha, the prince, before he went on his search. He had every need catered to, every desire satisfied. His father built him these three incredible palaces, one for each season, and descriptions are that the bed in which he slept in is like the size of this room, basically. And so it was every creature comfort was offered to him. And he found that he wasn't free. He found that there was still an enslavement going on, that something was still had this oppressive power to control that was greater than any external force or any external dictator. And that's really the force of our desires, of our minds. That we have this ability to create so much suffering for ourselves. And in spite of the fact that these external circumstances happen in our life, and there are the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows, so that pain and sorrow does arise outside of our control, there is a way in which our mind wants to change it, wants to either make it go away because we don't like it, or bring it, we want more of it, we get greedy because it's pleasant. So, for example, has anybody gotten angry at your own anger? Or depressed at your own depression? So this is the layer of suffering that the mind begins to create, and we begin to spiral if we aren't able to see it clearly. This is the power of our awareness, is to be able to see things clearly and see where are we actually contributing to our experience. And one of the questions is that when things become unpleasant, which they do, we know that, where is our practice? Can we even be at peace at that point in time when things become unpleasant? Because we actually don't know when the shit's going to hit the fan. We just don't know. There's the iPod did this advertising campaign, I think a year or two ago, called the iPod Shuffle. And I actually like the tagline, because it talks about this dynamic of we just don't know what is going to happen. It says, enjoy uncertainty. Random is the new order. Welcome to a life less orderly. Lose control and love it. That's what our life is one big iPod shuffle. You know, this random set of experiences that we, even though we try to control it. So I give you an example. I actually had the thought of ordaining in the year 2000. It was going to be my millennium thing. And I realized that just having the thought wasn't enough. I had to plan for it. You know, there was this, you know, I had to prepare my job. I had to prepare my relationship with my partner. I had to really carve this space out of a life that was completely full already. So you know what it's like to carve out half an hour each day to meditate. And it's very difficult to have a daily practice, right? So imagine you carving out 6 months of your life to drop everything. It took me 3.5 years to carve that out. And so when I got the things in place, one of the things that is, I wanted to follow it as traditionally as possible. Part of it was surrendering into the tradition to find out what is relevant about this way the teachings have been held for 2,600 years that's relevant today in this culture. So one of the questions that they pose to anybody who is a potential ordinee is, do you have your parents' permission if they're alive? So this is not just about telling your parents you're going to do something. When did you last ask your parents permission to do something? Well, I mean, my parents are still alive. It's been decades. So I went to them and I had this conversation and I asked for their permission and sort of, you know, explained what I was trying to do. And I thought that things were understood and the consent was given. And so this was in May of 2005, I think. I went to Thailand in October. And I arrived there, as I told you, I spent a week, you know, doing all those things. And then I went into the temple. And immediately when I go into the temple, I went into a retreat in order to really settle into the experience. I also wanted to get a flavor of the kind of practice that they do. Each temple has a little bit of a different flavor, and I wanted to become familiar with it if I was going to be living there for 6 months. So I'm already in retreat, and I get a call from my partner, and he says, I think you better call your mother, because she doesn't remember giving you permission to ordain. You know, you do the best you can and stuff happens. And it's like I saw my mind going in 20 different directions, you know, from rage to frustration to hurt to, you know, all of this stuff. And really opening up to the possibility of, well, what if this was okay? What if she didn't want me for whatever reason, and I hadn't talked to her, but I wanted to do this work before I was on the phone with her? What if I didn't ordain? What if I just practiced for 6 months, you know, so she doesn't want me to ordain? It was being vulnerable to the possibility that my expectations or my plans were not going to happen. And there was this freedom and this vulnerability to just let go into all these other forces that are impinging onto this experience. Sometimes we have this thought that we can be too vulnerable, you know, too open to the pain of the world, which there is a lot. You just open the newspaper and you feel it. I love what Sylvia Boorstein says about vulnerability. She says, what if everyone in the world were too vulnerable? What kind of world would we be? So I went through with the ordination. I was able to sort of talk my mother through her passive aggressive patterns of withholding permission. And I would say the most difficult part for me being away from family and friends and partner was probably the midpoint in the December January time frame. My family doesn't particularly celebrate Christmas, but it's a time of year in which the relatives all gathered. So we had this tradition of coming together, even though there wasn't a Christian celebration necessarily associated with it. And so, you know, I felt the isolation from that family connectedness because I knew no one in Thailand, and I also didn't speak the language. So it was really like being in a silent retreat, even though I wasn't in retreat all the time, because there was really no one to talk to. And there was one young Nepalese man who I ordained with, who spoke a little bit of English. His name was Bakash. And I remember on Christmas Day, I was feeling particularly sad and lonely. And we normally went to chanting in the morning together. And so at the end of the chanting period, he looked at me and saw that something was different, amiss. And I just said to him, I just need to go for a walk. So do you want to come for a walk? So we went on this walk, and you know, I was telling him as much as I could that I was just feeling disconnected, and I was these intense feelings of loneliness were coming up. And that, you know, in my home there's this week or two of celebration, and there's Christmas and there's New Year's, and he was sharing with me that Christmas has no impact in Nepal. It's not even on the radar, and how it, you know, they hear it as a more of as a commercial or marketing event than anything else. And so we walked for about 2 miles and came back to the temple, and I went back to my cottage. It's called a kuti, and this was now early evening, and I was about ready to go to bed, and I hear a knock on the door, and Bakash is there when I open the door, and he's standing there. He's this 23-year-old young man from Nepal. And he's standing there with this vase of freshly cut flowers. And he says, I don't know how to do this, but Merry Christmas. And it was really extraordinary, because the freedom I wanted was not to feel my feelings. And the freedom that I got was to feel them, and even feel all of them, sort of the bitter and the sweet. That if I wasn't present for the bitter part, I wouldn't experience the sweetness either. There's a doctor, Abraham Verghese, who is an East Indian who was raised in Ethiopia, and he came over to do his medical internship in the U.S. He did a lot of work with HIV patients in a very small town in Tennessee for a number of years. And he's a brilliant writer, because he went to the some of you may know the Iowa workshop at the University of Iowa. So he wrote this article recently about his experiencing experience volunteering during the Katrina disaster, and he was in Texas at the time. With the first busloads of Katrina refugees about to arrive in San Antonio, the call went out for physician volunteers, and I signed up for the 2 a.m. to 8 a.m. shift. On the way, riding down dark, deserted streets, I thought of driving in for my night shifts at the ICU as an intern many years ago, and how I would try to steel myself as if I were trying to put on armor. My first patient sat before me, haggard, pointing to what ailed her, as if speech no longer served her. I peeled her shoes from her swollen feet, trying not to remove skin in the process. Cuts from submerged objects and immersion in standing water had caused the swelling as well as infection of both feet. Near the end of my shift, a new group of patients arrived. A man in his 70s with gray hair and beard came in, looking fit and vigorous. One eye was milky white and sightless, but the glint in his good eye was good enough for two. His worldly belongings were in a garbage bag, but his manner was dignified. He told me that for two nights after the floods, he had perched on a ledge so narrow that his legs dangled in the water. At one point, he saw Air Force One fly by, and his hopes soared. I waited and waited, he said, but no help came. Finally, a boat got him to a packed bridge. There again, he waited. He shook his head in disbelief. Doc, they treat refugees from other countries better than they treated us. All I could say was, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. He looked at me long and hard, cocking his head as if weighing my words, which sounded so weak, so inadequate. He rose, holding out his hand, his posture firm as he shouldered his garbage bag. Thank you, Doc. That's all I needed to hear. All they got to say is sorry. All they got to say is sorry. Driving home, I remembered my own metaphor for strapping on armor for the night shift. The years have shown that there is no armor. There never was. The willingness to be wounded may be all we have to offer each other. That's the gift of vulnerability, is the willingness to be able to be with each other when we're hurt and not turn away. And we often turn away from suffering because it's so unpleasant. And so part of our practice, starting with this neutral object of the breath or the walking, we notice that as we anchor the awareness to the neutral object, unpleasant experiences and pleasant experiences automatically arise. And can we be there with all of them? So the body becomes painful. So the breath becomes labored. And beginning to meet that experience without this conditioned pattern of pushing it away, or wanting more because the sitting happens to be the calmest sitting you've ever had and you think that you're on, you know, you're on some other plane. Simply noticing your detailed experience without needing to have any other judgment. I have a friend in New York who I don't know whether you know people like this, but whenever we go out to eat, they always change what's on the menu. They will never order something off the menu straight. So if it's a pastrami sandwich, it has to be a pastrami sandwich with the edges cut off. Or if it's a dill pickle, it has to be a sweet pickle. Or if it's stir-fried vegetables, she has to know which vegetables are in season. And can you hear the suffering in that? Even though this person is thinking she's doing something to create happiness or a place of satisfaction. There is a piece of desire that all desire is the desire for no desire. Do you get that? That all desire wants that place of contentment. All desire wants the satisfaction. So in a sense, all desire seeks its own destruction. But desire itself doesn't have wisdom. And that's where the delusion sets in. That's where someone needs to tell her, and I'm not going to be the person, that this is not going to make you happy. Just because you are able to control that menu. And when we become aware, when the practice is not about going through life noticing your breath 24/7, right? The purpose of the practice is to strengthen this capacity to be aware so that the awareness will arise in our life. So that when we're in a joyous place or a difficult place, the awareness can be there so that we can fully live it. That's a moment of freedom, that awareness. The awareness of the craving or the attachment is not the attachment itself. The awareness of your anger is not the anger itself. Or the depression. And that may not feel like much, but it's enough of a crack in the wall as a door to go through so that this wall sometimes of this impenetrable state of mind can begin to be dissolved. The Buddha said, where there is attachment to the pleasant and aversion to the unpleasant, liberation is not possible. He doesn't speak of liberation as the free will to be able to do whatever we want to do. He speaks of liberation as liberation from greed, hatred, and delusion. So freedom isn't what we necessarily think it is. It's not a place that we get to. It's not a place that if we practice long enough, we'll be there. It's not a destination that is on some spiritual map that we have to find the directions to. That, in a way, is another kind of craving, another kind of attachment to freedom. In many of the traditions, the instruction is that there's nowhere to go and nothing to do. Just sinking in and letting go into this moment where there is freedom. That Ajahn Chah, the teacher of many of our teachers, has said, if you let go of a little, you have a little freedom. If you let go a lot, you have a lot of freedom. If you let go completely, you have complete freedom. So I mentioned the sometimes extreme patriarchy that exists in some Asian cultures, and particularly within Thai Buddhism, it runs quite strongly. We only get a very small slice of how Buddhism is practiced in Asia. That was one of the revelations that I had. And so one of my purposes was to get as broad an experience as I could in the short time. And I wanted to I wanted to meet and sit with senior women practitioners who are virtually invisible to the general public. And in Thailand, it's actually There are very, extremely few fully ordained women because of political and social circumstances. But there is one woman, Venerable Dhammananda, who is, she's been ordained for about 5 or 6 years. She was one of the first fully ordained nuns in Thailand. And she had to ordain in Sri Lanka in order to gain her status and came back. Her history is that she's a Buddhist scholar of some 40 years. So she didn't just fall into practice. She is an incredibly accomplished scholar as well. And when she ordained, she got the works. She got vilified in the press. She was accused of undermining the tradition. She was accused of destroying traditional values by bringing Western feminism into a spiritual practice. And so I wanted to sit with her and gain any insights that she had in. She has a temple that's outside of Bangkok, because the kind of oppression that she's experiencing is very parallel in terms of what I see for other marginalized communities in the West, whether they're people of color, whether they're gay lesbians, whether they're women, whether whatever kinds of differences that exist. I really wanted to find out how she brought her practice into dealing with this kind of suffering. And she said something when I was, you know, asking her, how do you deal with this? How do you deal with the cultural momentum against you? She said that she doesn't do this. She isn't a nun in order to change the Thai view of, or the cultural view of patriarchy, or the power imbalance. She's a nun because she needed to deepen her own experience with her nature, with her exploration of her spiritual path. So she didn't do this to change any cultural circumstance. She didn't do it to overthrow the patriarchy or change people's views on women. And then she said something that I've heard in the past, but coming from her because she lived it, I heard it differently. She said, the greater the challenge, the greater the heat. The greater the heat, the greater the purification of the heart. And that's what she was in it for, was the purification of her own heart. And in that ability to be free, even though it wasn't her intention to change the world around her, she is just by being there. Just by holding that space, the patriarchy is changing. And it's true, because there is growing support for the ordination of women, for parity within practice. So if you ever get a chance to go to Bangkok, she's really quite an amazing being to be around. True freedom doesn't mean to be in a place where there is no problem, struggle, or oppression. It means to be in the midst of those things and still be free in our hearts. Is that possible? It means to be surrounded by what we might think of as inequity and yet renounce the intention to harm. It means to be pressured by all kinds of urgencies in your life and yet forbear them with feelings of patience. And it means meeting your own difficulties, and we all have them, Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Meeting our own difficulties with compassion and simply making another resolution to be as good a person as we can be, the person that we see ourselves. So I'll just end with this passage by Khalil Gibran, who writes about freedom. And an orator said, "Speak to us of freedom." And he answered, "At the city gate and by your fireside, I have seen you prostrate yourself and worship your own freedom. Even as slaves humble themselves before a tyrant and praise him though he slays him, I, in the grove of the temple and in the shadow of the citadel, I have seen the freest among you wear your freedom as a yoke and a handcuff. And my heart bled within me. For you can only be free when even the desire of seeking freedom becomes a harness to you, and when you cease to speak of freedom as a goal and a fulfillment. Then you shall be free indeed, when your days are not without a care, nor your nights without a want or a grief, but rather when these things girdle your life, and yet you rise above them, naked and unbound." Thank you for your attention, and may we all rise above the 10,000 sorrows and the 10,000 joys. All of them, may we rise above them, naked and unbound. So we have some time if there are any. I prefer answers rather than questions, but I mean, you know, if there are questions also, or comments or anything that you have about your practice.
I'm Joel. And when you speak of people of color, I know what you're saying, yellow, black, brown, red. Is not a white person a person of color? Am I not a person of color? And if I don't know that, am I causing a problem?
So, you know, the term people of color, words are limited. Words are limited in their nature. So, the term person of color is like any other term. It has its own place. It's rooted in its place and time, and it happens to be a current term that's used. And not all black, brown, yellow, red people identify as people of color. For example, my parents don't identify as people of color. But there are groups of people who don't feel part or completely seen by the larger culture. And that's a term that they gravitate to. So, yes, you know, there are many shades of color, but it actually has a distinction in terms of identification. So, for example, I can use the identification of gay man for myself, but it doesn't describe who I am. Because maybe at one point in time it did, but my sense of myself is so much beyond that particular label. But I use it out of convenience, because there is a group that I sometimes refer to that way. And so that's how my understanding of that term is used. And so So you'll have to come to your own relationship to the term, whether, you know, it fits your experience or not.
I have one more question.
Sure.
If you didn't get permission from your parents, would you have not gone?
If I didn't get permission, I was already there, right? But I wouldn't have ordained. Because that is actually, I really wanted to find out, it's not necessarily about circumventing the process to get something. It's actually, for me, it was surrendering to the process to see what would unfold. And so that was my first lesson in letting go, and that was the letting go of control of what kind of experience I was going to have. Because I had all these lists of things of what I wanted to do as a monk, and looking back on it, it's pretty funny. Because I approached it so, I don't know, professionally. If you know what I mean. And it wasn't about that analytical mind. It was about what was going to come up. And things came up that I would never have predicted. You know, like this pilgrimage and meeting His Holiness and many things. So, thanks.
I'm Elliot. That made me think of something earlier you said. In the beginning you said that accepting difference is the beginning for peace. Trying to obliterate them is asking for trouble, for war. Or maybe you didn't say war, but at any rate, so I wonder, I hear what you're saying about letting go and if your parents had said no, but where is your responsibility to let yourself be different? How much should you, like, try to follow that part of yourself?
You know, I completely hear you around that, because I am really different than my parents. As we all are. And so really this is where the practice hits the road, is how do you hold both and? How do you hold both that we are absolutely unique beings, and also what is it about us that is totally connected? You know, how do you feel your way into that experience? Because actually, once you start putting it into words, we get scrambled. Because as soon as you put it down in words, it has to be either this or that, right? And it's not. It's not. Maybe this is a little risky, but I'll go there, because you raise a really interesting question around difference. So, I've been involved in many culturally specific meditation retreats. People of color, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, men's retreats, retreats for people who are in recovery. And some of the feedback, the pushback, or the resistance, I can label it as resistance, is that why do you need these retreats that actually separate people? This is not part of the teachings. It feels like a more of a separation than anything else. And so, you know, in the early times when these retreats first started, the justification was really to create safety for a group of people that may not feel safe in our household or lives, so that when you're constantly defended, it's very difficult to relax and explore that question of who am I? And this has been I mean, the place in which that has been really shown is the women's retreats that have been going on for 20 years, that they've really created the safety so that, you know, we have almost gender parity in the teaching platforms in the West, which was not the case 20 years ago. But actually recently, I've come to another thought of these culturally specific retreats. And that is, when our teachers, our current Western teachers, went over to the East to explore whatever spiritual tradition they explored, and they actually had these transformative experiences, when they came back to the West, what did they do? Well, I've actually asked them, and they said, well, we talked to our friends, and they talked to their friends, and you know, gradually began bringing a community together. And teaching friends and the friends of your friends, you're really more likely to bring like people from like backgrounds together than differences. So it's very interesting. Because when our Western teachers came back from India, they didn't go and teach and practice in the existing Asian temples that have been here since 1850, right? Why? Because they needed to create safety. They needed to create a practice space in which people could hear their similar life stories and experiences. They had to see themselves reflected in the teaching platform. Almost get to get the visceral sense, yes, I can do that if they can do that. This is exactly what, when people are attracted to culturally specific retreats, these are exactly the same reasons. So isn't that amazing? That in our expression of difference, we are the same. This is the profound level of commonality. And that, of course, the purpose of these retreats is not to permanently segregate. That the purpose of practice is to be able to practice anywhere, with anyone, under any condition. And which one of us is fully awake to do that? We need the vehicle to be able to get there incrementally. It's a very, you know, holding all of these issues with that kind of big mind is really what will allow us to stay together and really hold our different, because every community has different needs, right? And so to be able to hold all of them so that we don't necessarily have to fulfill all of them, are, you know, that everybody doesn't have to do everything. We can do our own things but still be part of a larger community. That's just some of my riffing.
I'm sure you did mention, you kind of struck on this a little bit. And you certainly did say that you needed to get permission from your mom. I'm looking at my own experience, and I think my mom's not with us anymore, but my dad is, and I look at him and I wonder if he wouldn't be just terribly hurt if I came out as well as the rest of the community, my previous church friends, I guess in that experience I was pretty well known. And it's going to be really hard at some point, not today, not tomorrow, but at some point, to come out. Can you speak a little bit about that? Or maybe you already have, kind of, you know.
Again, I wouldn't, I would invite you into the space of not knowing how, you know, that what is your intention behind the connection or relationship with, let's say, your father who you're talking about. And really to hold that intention, not knowing how that's going to unfold. So the issue of coming out and really disclosing that sense of authenticity and realness may or may not harm that relationship. And so that is something that has to be considered in the whole, you know, dynamic. And if there's a negative reaction, that's going to also affect your experience. So often in those places of not knowing is when we do our own practice, so that we, you know, and it doesn't feel like much in the moment. That's what I was saying about something else around practice in terms of offering loving kindness or offering compassion to people that feel completely shut down to us or not available to us in a certain area in our life. But it changes our relationship to it. And that's the most important thing. So in any, I'll talk about my relationship with my partner. What I began to realize in this particular relationship is that I have a relationship that he doesn't know about. Because when we are in relationship with people in the West, I have had this tendency to be overly expressive. You need to know what I'm feeling. Or what are you feeling? And sometimes that's just not helpful. You know, it's not everybody needs to know the recesses of my mind, which can get totally crazed. And all minds are like this because of hate, greed, and delusion. And so the part of the practice that has helped me is identify what are those areas that I need to share and what are those areas that I can contain myself. That if there's anxiety there or if there's experience there that I can either find other outlets for or not create more suffering that already exists in the relationship. So I know that it's not a clear answer, but it's really a perfect question because there is no clear answer to that kind of question. It's how messy that our lives get. And can we stay there as opposed to turn away? So thank you. I just know that we're getting close to our time, so maybe one more.
So I'd just like to add that in speaking to
something like that, it's going to be a journey that takes time with no specific ending. So, and I think intentions are important as how one might go about it. But it's a journey. it's a big adventure.
So thank you all for your practice, and have a good evening.